Hello and welcome to the Panorama podcast from the World Business Council for Sustainable Development. My name is Shane Griffin. On this podcast, we sit down with the world's key players in sustainability and look at the action being taken to tackle global challenges. Today, we look at the global food system. What are the challenges and what do we need to change to be able to feed 9 billion people by 2050? On today's podcast, I'm joined by Joanna Kane-Pataka, Director of Strategic Marketing and Communication at ICRISAT, which is the International Crops Research Institute for the semi-arid tropics. You are very welcome.
G'day, Shane. Thank you.
ICRISAT is a part of CGIAR, is that correct?
Correct.
And would you mind just explaining what ICRISAT and CGIAR are and what they do?
Sure. Well, the CGIAR, very unique actually. It's a consortium, a global consortium. There's 15 international research centres around the world that have come together to form this. Everyone has the same mission, which is about overcoming hunger, poverty, malnutrition and environmental degradation. And we all do it through the same way. So it's about science-backed solutions in agriculture. And each centre has a different focus. So there's a policy centre, a forestry centre, rice centre, fisheries centre, etc. And ICRISAT, so the centre I'm with, focuses on the semi-arid tropics, which is basically the drylands, which are the harshest environments. And the environments actually that have the highest malnutrition, the highest poverty, the biggest environmental issues from water scarcity, the areas where actually climate change is going to impact the most, and really the areas that are going to be the hardest to achieve the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals. So if we don't push, see, it's so easy, people tend to go for the low-hanging fruit. We've got to look also at the toughest areas, and if we don't tackle them now, we're not going to reach those SDGs.
And we're just over 2 years into the SDGs at this point. What progress are you seeing? Are you worried that maybe there is too much of a focus on the low-hanging fruit?
I think there is, and I think that's also a political challenge because people need to see impact as soon as possible when they're giving investments. We do need that as well. So how you balance that also with looking at the tougher areas. And these are big areas. These are about 60% of the agricultural lands, and so they're really important.
So you haven't picked an easy mandate for yourself, but it's obviously very important that we're not just focusing on the easier parts of achieving the SDGs. Just going back to CGIAR for a moment, it was established in response to a rising population and related food shortages. This is an issue that many listeners will be familiar with as the challenge of feeding a global growing population is given increased prominence. The surprising thing for me was that CGIAR wasn't established recently, but all the way back in 1943. When World War II was the most urgent problem. What's your take on the fact that we are dealing with many of the same issues now as we were back then?
Yeah, it is interesting that. I mean, there definitely have been a lot of achievements. I mean, that's just a reality that challenges continue. And if you look at what happened earlier, is the achievements were production-oriented. There were a lot of achievements. For example, when we got to, say, the 60s, and if I give an example of India, where they had the big Green Revolution, I mean, India was really reliant on food from the US, and they used to call it ship to mouth. Literally, they waited for the ships to come in to be able to feed the people. And at one stage, the country were down to 7 days of food supply. They were even asking people to fast 1 day a week. It was a really challenging time. And so thanks to CIMMYT, one of the CGIAR centres, one of the earlier ones, with their new wheat varieties, which produced significantly higher yields, I mean, it was claimed that that Green Revolution in India saved 250 million lives from starvation and death. I mean, that's huge. But of course, the negative impact then was the environmental impact because they used masses of fertilizers and pesticides. And so, yes, there were huge, huge solutions and successes, but then became recognised, okay, now then we've got to do this, but do this in a more environmentally sustainable way. So the focus changed. And then after that, really then became the recognition of the hidden hunger. So it wasn't just about enough food to eat. At that time, that's what they had to focus on. Literally, it was about death, starvation by death by starvation or some level of survival.
Was now for you, if I can jump in, has that conversation moved on? Are we primarily past that element of the food and agriculture challenge?
In many areas, not all, of course. There's still many areas where that's still a big issue. But definitely it's moved on now much more to being in, how do you do this with environmentally sustainable solutions, and how do you do it with the nutrition that's needed as well. And it's huge, huge impacts will come on the economy in the future if we don't overcome the malnutrition that's there in the developing countries. The effect that's going to have on the workforce is going to be mammoth.
We're almost 2 years into the SDG program at this point. What progress are you seeing? Are you worried that there is too much focus on the low-hanging fruit?
I mean, there's no one solution, of course, and it's going to take an effort of partnership globally to do this. And it's a way people work together. Certainly, there's a huge recognition of doing this from the ground up now. It's not a case of bringing in technologies, and it's the case of how you work with the local people. It's about them driving the change and leading. Even the CGIAR now, often the description of what we do is seen as a catalyst. We're the catalyst, we're the knowledge brokers, we bring a lot of expertise, but it's about how we work with the people on the ground and that they're driving the solutions. It's really important.
You've touched there on the social impact of food and agriculture challenges globally. As we know, rural communities are in trouble across the globe. In many cases, they are shrinking or aging, while in developing countries, rural communities are regularly among the most impoverished. What are the steps that we can take, in your view, to address this issue?
An example is at ICRISAT, it was just over 40 years ago that we started work on what was called the watershed work, where you really go in and look at the whole access to water for agriculture and bringing in solutions. And when they did this over 40 years ago, they worked closely with communities. Then 3 years later, they went back and found none of the technologies they'd worked on were continued. So then they realised, and this is decades ago, of course, but they realised it's the approach that they take, how they set it up so the communities are leading it, how they link the communities with the government programs, how they form consortiums. And so the whole became a whole science around delivery as well, not just science around discovery and technology.
So your aim there is to empower rural communities. Are you seeing success in this approach?
Okay, so there's a lot of people working on this, and we know it's across different parts of the value chain. I think I'll just add one comment on this, and that is to think of it as being a business proposition. A lot of the solutions we work on, whether it's about poverty, malnutrition, or where you're saying now food wastage, you've got to make something commercially viable for it really then to be sustainable and continue. So look at the issues that are there. I'll give one example. So in Tanzania at the moment, there's quite a crisis on because they were producing pigeon pea, which is a pulse, and exporting all of it to the Indian market. And India was encouraging them to produce because India had an undersupply compared to their huge demand. But in the meantime, the Indian government also had a policy to be pulse self-sufficient, and they were very successful in achieving that. So almost overnight, Tanzania had no market for their huge production of pigeon pea. And because they didn't need it, I mean, they literally were just letting the food rot in the fields. They just huge, huge areas across the whole country just rotting, and the farmers could eat it. But it wasn't something they knew about. There weren't any value chains developed internally in their country to deal with that. So there's an example of huge food wastage, but there's good commercial opportunities domestically for them.
So is better planning the best way to approach this challenge and ensure we don't have the same problems in future?
Planning and planning with a business in mind,
okay.
Yeah.
So commercial viability is always going to be an essential part of this. And you mentioned the environmental impact of the food and agriculture system earlier. We know it accounts for a third of all greenhouse gas emissions. Is this challenge being addressed through global food initiatives?
I mean, there's a lot happening in that area as well. But I want to bring up a point which often is overlooked that, okay, so we know livestock is a major contributor to that. But we have to separate some of the developing country areas that rely on livestock versus the rest of the world. There's a lot of very arid areas, very poor people, where they have almost no other agricultural alternative. And that needs to be separated from this more general statement about we need to reduce livestock and consumption of meat, which absolutely must happen to make significant improvements in the greenhouse gas issues, but to separate that. And so we know that means then diet changes globally. And I think we forget also about the marketing side of things. It's not just about telling people we need to change. It's about how do we make the alternatives exciting? So rather than focusing on don't do something, let's give good alternatives and let's change that. And the food processing industry can play a huge role here as well.
The Paris Agreement and the Sustainable Development Goals are relatively flexible frameworks in terms of how they are implemented nationally. So you're suggesting that we should use that flexibility to promote livestock cultivation in certain areas where it's the best form of agriculture available, while maybe in more developed countries we should try to cut back on meat consumption.
Yeah. It's a little bit like, if I use a parallel, the water footprint. Especially in Europe, there's been a push around having water footprint on products so that people recognize it and don't buy products with a high water footprint. Well, you know, water footprint isn't necessarily a negative. It depends where that particular product is growing, and there may be lots of water versus other areas, like because we work in the dry lands, then it's really important. And there's a big push and support for a lot of these large commodities which shouldn't be grown there in these drier areas, but they are, simply because the whole value chain is set up and the big industry is behind it and supports it.
And this, of course, goes back to the issue of efficiency that we spoke about a little earlier. So we're only 12 or so minutes into the podcast, but we've already tackled emissions, rural poverty, and feeding a growing population. This all needs to be done, of course, in the context of improving human health and nutrition. And the World Health Organization regularly releases studies, such as one last year, which revealed that global obesity rates have doubled between 1990 and 2017. How can this issue be addressed?
You know, again, I think it's coming back to the marketing and working with the processing industry. So, I mean, and it's a little bit like what we're doing with the smart food movement, where we're really, well, smart food we define as food that's good for you, so it's highly nutritious and healthy, good for the planet, so it's environmentally sustainable, and good for the farmer. So the farmer's getting a fair deal out of this and it's useful for them. The approach we're taking is to bring in smart foods. It's about how you market them, how you make them convenient and healthy, and especially with processing, how you can do the processing so it keeps the nutritional value, so it's still healthy. I think there's a huge movement that will happen, and it has to happen, in still being able to have processed foods. Convenience is important, but can we do that so it stays healthy and nutritious? And I think that's a big challenge that we have to tackle if we're going to tackle some of these big nutrition issues. You know, a large food processor said to me the other day, they said, well, reality is fat, sugar and salt taste good. Absolutely. And I was like, wow.
That's a challenge.
And actually, I was really interested. I was in Australia last year for their biggest food science conference of the year. And I was absolutely surprised how every session, whether nutrition and health were on the agenda or not, almost every session the issue came up of tasty food versus healthy food, as if they were at two ends of the spectrum and they didn't meet. And that's our challenge. We've got to make those meet. And food processors can do it. We've got the technologies and the science, so let's see how we can actually achieve that.
Okay, and my last question, we've spoken about it a bit in the context of marketing and other areas, but where does business best fit into this effort, and how can it best affect change in these areas?
Well, certainly it's become a big trend, the PPP, the private and public partnership. So I'd put the emphasis on the last P, that partnership. So it's not business that can do it alone. It's not government that can do it alone. All civil society is there too. It's the whole partnership that can really make a big difference. I would say we need to bring retailers in as well in a big way. They can make huge impacts because retailers can really, really influence what's able to be sold through them. And so, and I'd actually say, I think a new trend that I'm seeing is with social entrepreneurs. Now, I especially see this in developing countries, and I'm so inspired by it. It's amazing what you see in India, Indonesia, other countries too, where there's people who are really genuine about having nutritious foods, about being environmentally sustainable, and about the, really caring about the rural communities as well. I think there's a growing movement, and I think if we can support that growing movement as well, that can also radically change this food system.
Thank you, Joanna. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today, but there's so much food for thought there, if you'll excuse the pun, and it's been excellent to dive into a few of those areas with you today. If listeners would like more information on any of these subjects, visit wbcsd.org, and don't forget to subscribe to and rate the Panorama podcast on iTunes. We look forward to you joining us again next time.